All right, welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, on this blustery and fall-like Friday here in eastern Massachusetts at our lovely... Who was it, Norm Nathan used to talk about his plush but not overly ostentatious studios?
That's it, yeah.
Norm Nathan, and I just missed working with him at WESX. I just missed it, and missed Norm Nathan and the great Larry Glick and who was the guy on Brudnoy.
Yeah.
I thought Brudnoy was the greatest interviewer of all time. I thought he's the most well-read man I've ever listened to on the radio. All right, let's shut the music off, and what do we have on Trending Now this week?
Well, we have Larry Costa, who is, in addition to being a classmate of mine from high school, is spent a career working in the military and then became a prominent defense contractor, and he is moving back to Gloucester and settling down here. He's semi-retired but still keeps a hand in the defense industry, and we'll be talking to him about his career, his journey, and maybe some things about national politics.
Okay, that sounds interesting.
And we have two of the successful candidates from the Gloucester election. I'm going to do a little bit of post-mortem on the election, Paul Lundberg and Ken Heck.
Okay, very good. There we go. So that's all upcoming here in the next hour on Trending Now on MSO News Sports. And don't forget, lots of football this weekend. Tonight, starting at 7 p.m., pregame around 6:20, 6:25, it'll be Marblehead at Melrose for the Division III North Championship. That's live on MSO Radio Channel A. We'll be right back with Trending Now.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is a former Gloucester High School classmate of mine, Larry Costa. Larry, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Josh. Thank you.
Well, usually you start out and have people give us a little bio about themselves. So tell me about, I know all your life story, but share with our listening audience, from Gloucester and the military and so forth.
Oh, well, I was born in Gloucester, as was my mother and grandmother before me. I went to Gloucester High. I graduated with you in 76, went on to Norwich University, graduated from Norwich in 1980, went off to the military for approximately 12 years where I served in the Army Special Forces. And in 1992, I left the military to go to law school and start a business.
Great, and you remained in the reserves all that time, correct?
Yeah, I spent 18 years in the reserves, assigned to 11th Special Forces Group out of Fort Devens for a while, and then I transferred down to U.S. Special Operations Command Central down in Tampa, and I served down there for about 10 years, I believe it was, and then I left the reserves after that. But I'd served, I think, total somewhere in the vicinity of 24 years, maybe, wow. 26 total. So it was quite a bit.
And I remember back in high school when we were in ROTC, we trained at Devens with the Special Forces people.
Oh yeah, and that was one of the things that inspired me to join Special Forces was having had that contact in high school through the JROTC program at Gloucester High. I think we probably went three or four times, Josh,
yeah.
when we were in high school.
Yeah.
And it was such a fun time, and these guys were such professionals, and they were they were great guys that you wanted to emulate. So I think that's one of the inspirations I had in going into the Army and joining Special Forces, and it was a good experience. It was a lot of good people doing a lot of great things, so it was awesome.
I remember being on the rifle range in one of the pits and shooting live ammunition of M14s and being in the bunker next to Joe McKechnie, and he ends up with 21 bullet holes in his target and had to shoot again to requalify because one of mine went astray.
Yeah. I'll tell you, it's one of those things that happens quite a bit.
Well,
just as much on active duty as it does with a bunch of JROTC kids.
Yeah.
There's always that one or two stray rounds that throws off the qualification and just have to reshoot.
What?
Nothing wrong with that at all. But yeah, I remember those M14s. I remember the whole Devens thing. So it was a lot of fun. We never, you never knew how much fun it was until after you had a while to sit back and think about it.
Yeah. So you went in the military, and then you started a business, and somewhere along the way, you get in the business of being a defense contractor. Describe what that is, what it involved, and tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I was on active duty in the military, and I was thinking I was realizing that I was going to be leaving the military soon. We had a big downsizing going on as a result of the peace dividend back in the early 90s, and they offered me a great package to separate. So I took the package, and as I was separating, I thought, and at the time I was going to law school at night, I thought, well, what am I going to do once I get off active duty? Am I going to work as a lawyer? Am I going to work as a law clerk? What am I going to do? And I started thinking, some of the things that I'd seen the military contract out were things that I could easily replicate and do myself. So I started thinking, well, what's some of the easier things to do in the sense of the amount of capital needed to do it? And one of the things that they were contracting out at the time was language training, and the capital requirements weren't that high, and I knew a lot about language training, having been in the military, having participated in military language training, so I decided I'd stop bidding on those contracts. And I was very successful in getting those contracts and winning those contracts and executing those contracts, and they kept on coming back for more and more training, and we kept on winning more and more, and then we went from doing work just at Devens to expanding out to North Carolina, Fort Campbell, Kentucky, Fort Lewis, Washington, and doing work at those various locations for the various military elements at those locations. And that went on quite successfully for a number of years. And then, as a result of the peace dividend, also, we were starting to do training exercises. The U.S. military was starting to do training exercises with the Albanians and a number of other former Eastern European countries. And they needed interpreters. Well, one of the organizations I provided language training to came to me and asked me if I could provide them interpreters in those languages. Well, I'd known quite a few individuals from Eastern Europe. I knew there was a very big community in the New England area. So I started actively recruiting, and I found that, yes, indeed, I had the people they needed. And they said, okay, I was awarded a contract to provide that support, and subsequently that contract went out as a multi-year contract at multiple locations, competitively bid, and I won it. So, and that's when we started getting into translation and interpretation, which again only grew as a result of 9/11.
Wow. So what are some of the languages that you would provide people for, people that spoke a particular language or could train or interpret? What languages and for what countries?
Oh, we've trained in almost every language. I mean, we've done training in Albanian here in the U.S. We've done training in South Africa for Afrikaans. We've done training for Russian. We've done Russian language training in Kazakhstan. We've done Russian language training in Estonia. We've done French language training in Montreal. We've done French language training in Martinique, which is in the Caribbean here. So we've trained just about every language in the world, and we've provided translators and interpreters in probably just about as many languages. We have over 500 translators deployed today working for four different countries.
Wow. Now, you also do – so you do contract work for the United States government, but you also work for other governments.
Yeah, we work for the Australian government, the Canadian government, and the British government.
Wow. And it's the same range of services?
Same range, training and interpreters and translators.
And what are some of the training things that you do?
Well, we'll provide overseas immersion training for any government agency that desires it. For instance, we'll send somebody to a four-week immersion program in Germany where they'll learn German and they'll stay with a German family. We probably did that for over. We also did work for Walmart. We did a significant amount of work for Walmart when they were on the big international push and they were opening store after store in Germany. We trained almost all their store managers in German, and they spent, I think, on average 3 to 4 weeks in Germany learning German. We also trained the store managers for Walmart going to China in Chinese, and that was a very successful program. As was our training program for them in Brazilian Portuguese for the store managers going to Brazil.
Wow. And how many do you personally speak or understand other languages?
Well, I speak German. I started at Gloucester High with my German and continue it throughout the rest of my life. And today I use my German probably every couple months visiting Germany or talking to people that speak German in other parts, wherever that they may be. We might be on a cruise, and there might be some German couple there, and I'll talk to them in German. One of the guys just came to my house a few minutes ago to do some work for me was a German, so I spoke a few sentences with him. But, yeah, I speak German pretty well, thanks to Gloucester High. And then I also know a little bit of Spanish and a little bit of Arabic.
I ran into Sarah Pacone in the supermarket several years ago, and I had her for French in junior high school and then in high school. And I said, "Mrs. Pacone, I'm going to get to use my French." She said, "Oh, are you going to France?" I said, "No, I said I'm going to Canada." She said, "Well, that's not quite the same thing, but that's okay." But
yeah.
She looked the same, and she knew me right away, and that was great. It was great. Being a defense contractor, there has been certainly a fulfilling and rewarding experience for you. How much is the politics of the ebb and flow of what happens impact you? And you know, do you have some experiences to share? I was headhunting back in the late 90s, beginning of the century, and I noticed that, and I think it coincided with with what you call the peace dividend, that a lot of the people who were in technology that were in the defense industry, as they downsized the defense industry, these people went into games. And because of the gaming software, so the leading people in games started out. They were a big rush of military applications as opposed to a lot of other things. Any thoughts about that and anything else you'd want to share like that?
You know, I think in regards to politics affecting what I do, pretty much the world goes on no matter who's in Washington, D.C. And I think no matter who's in Washington, D.C., they don't really want to get into a conflict overseas. I don't think they want that. And a lot of my work involves conflict. So I think conflict avoidance is the priority of both parties in Washington or whoever's in Washington. So politics plays little in what I do. More so are the actions of outsiders that force our government to act.
Yeah,
that's when I get involved, because okay. That's when my people deploy. For instance, if something happened in Somalia, I'd be deploying people to Somalia. If something happened in Europe, I'd be deploying into Europe. The same with Korea. You know, it would all depend on where somebody else is forcing us to act. Because, again, I don't think either party in D.C. wants to deploy troops overseas. That's just not something... Yeah. That's always a good idea. So I think politics plays little in what I do. That's just, nobody wants hostilities. And because nobody wants hostilities, then, it has an effect on my business to the point where my peacetime work is at a certain level. My wartime work would increase if hostilities commence somewhere. Okay. But I don't think either side wants hostilities, and I don't want hostilities. I wish that, my business would always stay at its peacetime size, because we don't need that. The U.S. doesn't need any further hostile engagements than what we already have. So I'm not, I'm one of the few defense contractors. I tell everybody, I wish I was out of business.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that's a necessary thing. So we stand ready to deploy people with the military when they need us, how they need us, and where they need us.
And that's a change. That's a change from the pre-peace dividend. As I understood it, and correct me if and where I'm wrong, but I understood that prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, that for every combat person we put into the field, there was a backup of 18 people, personnel, to support that person in combat. So that when the peace, when the Iron Curtain came down and we were into what the delayering downsizing the military and so forth, the approach taken by the government was to say, we don't need to have those carrying costs in overhead. We'll just allocate the money and farm it out to people, as opposed to having to have that all up front. Is that right? Do I understand it right?
Yeah, they do farm out quite a bit of work that they formerly had military personnel perform, such as the postal services. Because one of the things my company does do, in addition to the language work, is we operate the post office in Bagram, Afghanistan. And the reason we operate the post office is because the military decided that it's far more cost efficient to have a contractor run it than to have military personnel run it. And we've been running that post office now for, I'd say, close to 10 years.
Wow.
And it's just, They do a cost analysis, because when they have a contract to do it, they don't have to worry about medical, they don't have to worry about retirement benefits.
Yeah.
None of the stuff are training. They just hire someone direct to do it. And then when they give it to another contractor, or they change contractors, then, they don't worry about the employees, unemployment, or any of that. So it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
The government to take some of these skill sets and farm them out to contractors. Same thing with like mechanics, okay? Wheeled vehicle mechanics, unless it's some type of specialty, such as a tracked vehicle mechanic for a
a tank or something, or a helicopter mechanic that's military specific, I think they're probably far better off to contract it out than to maintain a person within the organization that eventually they get to worry about the medical, the insurance, and all the other benefits.
Yeah. Well, when I was in grad school, I had a professor for managerial economics, and we were talking after class one day, and this is pre-fall of the Soviet Union, and I asked him, and his opinion was, and this is probably 1988 or so, and he said, when the Cold War ends, it will end without, you know, either side firing a nuclear missile at each other. And what he explained to us was that the Cold War was the arms race was really about economics. And he said that the United States' capacity to, it had to do with the gross national product what we could mobilize and industrialize outstripped other countries 4 or 5 to 1. And that the reason the Russian government would ultimately lose the Cold War is that they lacked the capacity to take care of the people and keep up with an arms race. And when the people had enough with that, they'd change their form of government. And that's just in 1988, and when the Soviet Union came down and people got a look inside of Russia and realized, you know, the standard of living was so much different than it was in Europe or other places around the world, I said, boy, he was right. So, any thoughts?
Well, my first trip, well, first off, I think it is all about economics. I think the entire Cold War, it was an economic war and not a fighting war, because the whole issue was to outlast the other side when it comes to spending, especially considering the amounts of money that had to be spent on that. But I went to Russia in 1992, 93-ish, I believe. That was my first trip. I've probably been to Russia 20 or 30 times. And, you know, I was kind of, when I got there, I was looking around, and it was like America in the 1930s, 1940s,
yeah.
Just the construction equipment they had was so old and so poorly, well, it had to have been well-maintained to be run. It's still running, but it was just old.
Yeah,
everything
yeah.
in Russia was old, worn down, just a lot of neglect, and it was crazy. And you could see where they had deprived the civilian side of the economy for the sake of the military side of the economy. There's no way they could cover the expenditures on both sides. And you walk through the city, and I made friends with some doctors. I went to their house to see how they lived. And these two were doctors. They were doctors. Their mother and fathers were doctors. Their grandparents were doctors. And before that, their grandparents were doctors. So this being doctors was a generational thing.
Yep.
Well, you would assume after the second, third, or fourth generation of doctors that they would be living quite well.
Yeah,
that was not the case. Both the husband and the wife had to go out to a dacha, which is a villa in the countryside, every summer, almost every weekend, to grow vegetables to make sure they had enough to eat.
Wow.
And this is 1992, 93.
Wow.
So, yeah, obviously, you know, obviously the Russians were seriously depriving their civilian side of the house with the funds they needed for them to live, you know, at what we would consider a reasonable level of comfort. Today it's a little bit different. I've talked to those doctors maybe once a year. I talk to them via the internet, but I saw them in person about 3-4 years ago. And things had gotten better, okay? Things had gotten a little bit better for them. Was it to our standards? No. Is it what we would consider the standard that two doctors should be living at? Absolutely not. So, you know, you look, and they're still trying to recover over there, but they can't go back to what they what the system was like before. As much as they sometimes I think there's some people over there would like to do that. I just don't think it's possible for them to do that because the people are so deprived of the basic necessities of life.
I noticed that when all of the stories came out after when the United States and Russia were more allied, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a exchanging of information, and that one of the things that came out is that Khrushchev, with all his bluster and threats and everything else, that some of the long-range missiles that he said were pointed at the United States, they had questions back during the Cuban Missile Crisis whether they could even get them off the launch pad, because they were antiquated and lacked support or the parts or whatever, and let alone hit the United States or anything.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Josh, I'm reluctant to say anything about the Russian military out of professionalism.
Oh, okay.
But I will say that our apprehension of their military should not have been as great as it was.
Yeah.
All right. I don't think their military was as big a threat as people made it out to be after seeing what I saw in St. Petersburg, and I also traveled to southern Russia, to the Crimea, and looking around and seeing the things that I had seen. I won't say it today, it's probably a wonderful military machine, but back in the early 90s, I think that it was just surviving, and I think that there was a lot of maintenance issues created by by a lack of financial support. That's what I think.
Well, Eisenhower, as general and then as president, took the approach. He knew we had military superiority in terms of missiles, but he downplayed it, and he created the impression that maybe we were falling behind. Or we were more level than we were because he didn't want it to accelerate and escalate into something that so many people thought was just sheer madness. Then Kennedy runs against Nixon. Nixon and Kennedy gets the briefing documents about what our strength is, and he goes after Nixon and says, "You're letting America fall behind," and Nixon can't come out and say what's true because he it's classified, which was a great debating thing on Kennedy's part. But it was interesting, and so there was some sense of knowing where we were in relation to that. But then there was also some denial of it because the military-industrial complex was able to benefit from it. And the bases and the contracts were all in key voting states and all, and that's part of what that whole thing was about during that military buildup.
Well, when it comes down to the military buildup, comes down to why and all that. I guess it comes down to at the end of the day, we were able to spend the Russians. And we basically bankrupt them.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you look at the stuff, you look at the equipment, the training, and the organization that the U.S. has created as a military. It is by far the best military on the planet. And it can respond to a number of situations, be they hostilities, humanitarian aid, disaster relief. They can do it all, and they have done it all. And I think, having served within that organization, it was really an honor for me. And I'll tell you something, it's the best military in the world. And I'll tell you also that because of that early spending, that's what made it the best military in the world. And I think, it will continue to be the best military in the world. Right now, we're able to deal with threats worldwide and in some cases without even having to deploy troops. So, I think thanks to that early spending, we were able to get to where we are, and we've been able to maintain that high standard.
Teddy Roosevelt's, walk softly but carry a big stick.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Well, Larry, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I look forward to when you're back in the country and we can do lunch again. And good luck with your new house, your summer cottage that you picked up on Atlantic Road.
All right. You take care and be well, Josh.
Thank you, Larry. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 Series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
People come in, take a seat. You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night. Satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
NewSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players, exclusive video interviews following the big games, live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball, live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Paul Lundberg, city councilor at large in Gloucester and city councilor-elect in Gloucester. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Well, thank you very much, Josh, and thanks for having me on.
Well, we just got through a race for mayor, school board, and city council here in Gloucester. And observations on the election, its results, and the message from the voters, and what direction that sets for the next couple of years.
Well, thanks for the question. It's a great question, and I think that this election was a very, very important election for the reasons, for the issues that you just talked about. The voters really spoke, and the voters, you know, I always have a great deal of faith in their wisdom, and they certainly showed that wisdom this time. They were where they had a choice, particularly in the councilor-at-large race. They had five incumbents to choose from. They had a newcomer, and they had a former city councilor, so we'll call him an ex-incumbent. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that incumbents have an opportunity, and that wasn't what happened. First of all, the newcomer, Jen Holmgren, came in third, very close to the top, and she ran a great campaign and spoke to a lot of people, a lot of the segments of our citizenry. She had a great message. She was very articulate, and as a newcomer, she won, and that was pretty terrific. Melissa Cox, who was a Ward 2 counselor and decided to run at large, she topped the ticket. She had also spoke to the voters across the city with her message of civic involvement. She's very big on that. One other thing that happened that was quite interesting is that one of the other candidates who was an incumbent or is an incumbent and will not be on the council chose to involve partisan politics into the race by getting endorsed by the Republican governor and the Republican lieutenant governor, something that has never happened before in our nonpartisan city elections, and turned out that didn't work. In fact, it turned out that that counselor didn't do very well at all, and I just hope that there's a message there from our voters that our city elections are nonpartisan and that voters want them to stay that way.
It's interesting. It's an interesting observation. What I saw looking across multiple cities is Democrats seem to prevail in most elections. I wondered the extent to which the voters are saying they want elections nonpartisan, or whether it was something about they wanted people who weren't Republicans. And those are two different stories, it's interesting. And I had clients who in other communities who were independents and said, well, I wasn't a Democrat and I wasn't a man. Hindered her chances. I'm always interested in what other people's takeaways are from an election. In relation to the issues, there are a lot of things that were engaged. I know the Fuller School Project continues to be uppermost in people's minds. When is that going to get back on the tax rolls? When is it going to get to the next stages? And some of the other issues that you folks are going to be dealing with, the new council is going to be dealing with as you start out.
Yes, well, the Fuller School, completing that project, which is now before the city council for their major project permit, and that will be decided by the new city council. That is a development project, and it also has this component of affordable housing. How we deal with that is going to be very important. Another new member to our city council, Ken Heck, who won in 2, and he's a newcomer, but he's got a real estate development background, and he will have some very helpful perspective. And he's currently on the planning board, by the way. He will have some very helpful perspective.
He's also a civil engineer, isn't he?
He was what?
He's also an engineer by trade. Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
I think by education he's an engineer. But he's very—he's a very articulate person and a very observant person, and I think that'll help on that particular issue. The other issue that we have locally that's serious and before the council, because it's going to impact our quality of life, is where we permit the siting of retail recreational marijuana facilities. That the voters approved the legalization of marijuana, but left it to the cities and towns to do the zoning and all that kind of stuff, and that's clearly right in our basket of things that we have to do in the next term, and it's going to be pretty important where and what kind of community impact we have as to where those retail facilities might go.
And some cities up and down the North Shore are not letting it in. They're
correct.
They can go somewhere else. They've voted as a council or a town board to not open those doors to people. Now, Gloucester is not one of those that has shut the door. But what is there an issue around how many?
The state law says that if your voters approved retail marijuana, that the number of facilities that you have is a percentage of your liquor licenses, which in Gloucester translates into 4. And if we, the city or the citizens, want to have 4 or less, that has to go back to the voters in next November, because as a city, we voted in favor of the ballot resolution. towns and cities that voted down the ballot resolution, they were able to make that decision about whether to allow retail outlets just on a town council basis. But okay. We have to go back to the voters in Gloucester.
So right now, the permit that's been issued is for one, and can anybody else apply and get one, or that would be subject to a vote by the public?
Well, just to be clear, the permit that we've granted is for the medical marijuana,
okay,
which is a whole different ball of wax than the retail recreational, and so that's the thing we're dealing with now. The medical marijuana thing, that's one facility. We passed it. It's sited in the Blackbird Industrial Park, and that game is over right now. So what's in play is the retail recreational stores.
Okay. All right. That's great. What are some of the other things that are going to be hot in the coming year? What happens now to the leadership for the council? And maybe it's too early to talk about that, but the council president, the incumbent, Joe Shalina, narrowly defeated and came in fifth. Throw their hat in the ring and see how it comes out, or?
Well, the city charter now says that the elected councilors will, among themselves, elect a president, and that will occur on January 1st after we're all sworn in. Of course, as in anything political, you know, people are making their desires known. My position on this, Josh, is I'm certainly interested in that role, but I have said to all my fellow councilors there are three things that, in this order, that are important. Number one, what's the most important thing for the council? Number two is what's the most important for our voters who elected us? And then the third is what's important for each individual, and what does each individual in the council bring, you know, in terms of their skills? And so I'm saying to my fellow councilors that I hope they, you know, I honor their ability to make that choice, and I hope they look at my qualifications favorably.
The mayor said something interesting on election night on cable television, where she said, a mayor's only as good as your city council. And I thought that was an interesting observation on her part. What about the relationship between the council and the mayor? I know in the charter they were set up as with a certain amount of institutional rivalry, be it through a check and balance system, and yet it's important to have both entities working in tandem. How is that balance now, and how do you see that changing going forward?
I think you're right about the charter and the checks and balances, and that's very important. And the council does have that ultimate check and balance in reviewing and approving the mayor's budget. And we do that on a line-by-line basis in a very, you know, detailed way during the months of April, May, and June. As a general notion, though, my belief is that we should find ways to support one another, we, the council, and the mayor. You know, by the charter, the mayor is the chief executive, and he or she is in charge of running the bureaucracy. And the city council really doesn't have a role in running the bureaucracy, but we certainly have a role in setting the direction for the city and the kind of things that the citizens are interested in. You know, we really represent the people. So, but I think that a cooperative a relationship is important with the idea that there are checks and balances.
Good. I know that in the old Plan E form of government, the city council was the executive branch, and they entrusted that, the administration of the bureaucracy, if you will, to a town administrator or a city manager, and much like a school committee and a superintendent does, but the wisdom of our leaders was for a democratically elected mayor, and Framingham just went that way, and it just had their first popularly elected mayor this year, in this election. So what's happened in Gloucester is spreading out, I guess.
Yeah, it sure is. And Josh, I know that you are a student of these things, and I think that our charter with the mayor as the chief executive works well. Yeah, I think it works well that we stand for election every 2 years, and the voters can make their decision on a real-time basis, and I think it's working well. And I just think that we need to remember that we're representing the citizens, and we need to make our city go forward.
Well, great. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on Trending Now, and wish you the very best of success going forward with your position as an at-large councillor and leading the city council in whichever capacity suits you and the council.
Great.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for doing this service, Josh. Thank you.
Take care.
Stronger, faster, tougher. When you need the MVP of community banks, look no further than the Institution for Savings, with 14 full-service offices throughout the North Shore. We have MVP rates and an all-star team to serve you. Bank from the ball field with our 24/7 online application apps, internet banking, mobile deposit, and more. Institution for Savings, your winning team. Visit institutionforsavings.com, member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. Our company has been proud to have supported high school sports on the North Shore for more than 30 years. Our student athlete program recognizes championship performance in the classroom and on the field. Moynihan Lumber is also committed to championship performance when it comes to meeting all your building and home improvement needs. And if you're planning to change your kitchen, please visit our kitchen cabinet showrooms at any of our three locations. In Beverly, North Reading, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at moynihanlumber.com.
Get the skills you need to be a leader in sports and recreation. A master's in athletic administration from Endicott's Van Loan School prepares students for careers in schools, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, sports governing bodies, private sports clubs, and more. Van Loan's athletic administration master's program is 100% online with affordable tuition. Try a class before fully enrolling. Visit vanloan.endicott.edu/athleticadmin today.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies, and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
MSONewsSports.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at MSO News Sports or on Facebook. And you can always email us at MSONewsSports@gmail.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Ken Hecht, who is a city council-elect in Gloucester in Ward 2. Ken, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, congratulations again on your victory in Ward 2, your first time out as a elected position here in Gloucester. Now that you've got through an election night and I'm gathering, caught up on some much-needed sleep, what are your thoughts about the election?
About the election? I think that the election was about what the citizens of Gloucester want in terms of the direction that they want to go. I think it's a very progressive council. There's a lot of bright people that got elected, and I think that we can really, if we focus, we can really do some great things for Gloucester together. Really, really accomplish some great things.
Great.
That's the exciting part. Is the crew. The crew is great. Great crew. Time to go.
Tell us
to make things happen.
Tell us about what it was like campaigning in Gloucester, what it involved for you, what you found were the highlights, if you will, the things that were labor-intensive. Share some of the thoughts from the campaign trail with us so we understand what an ordeal that can be.
Yeah, it's more than people think. It's been a year now since I first decided to run and read a book and outlined the book and created a business plan and then executed on the business plan. So I've been really working on this for a year between all the brochures, knocking on 600 doors, the majority of which, almost all of which, were done before September 1st. A lot of people think that, you know, elections start on September 1st and then there's an election in November and that's it. But it really, if you want to, you know, do a good job, it starts so many, many months before that.
If you're going to run really for mayor, not, if you're going to run for mayor in a city, you want to be pretty sure that you've got your team lined up by New Year's Day, or at least your decisions made by New Year's Day, to be one of the first to announce in January.
Yeah, I've never run for mayor or contemplated it, but you know,
it is an early timetable. Yeah.
That's what I did for city council, and it's, you know, 600, door, knocking on 600 of the 1,600 actual voters in Ward 2, of the 3,500 registered voters in Ward 2. So it was really lining out, you know, who the people I needed to talk to, and then the inevitable coffees and the functions and the all the questions people had as we got closer to the election, and the term papers I wrote to answer these 20 questions and these 4 questions and these 8 questions, and then... No. The forums and the debates and you know, the mailings and it's in the street, you know, being out there with the signs. A lot of people, I get pretty animated with my signs, and I became known as sort of the animated sign guy, which is kind of fun.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. What when you were going door to door? What did you hear? What did people say to you?
Well, I mean, it was just such a wide variety, you know, it, in the neighborhoods of the Fort and, you know, the Hill. You know, there's a lot of people concerned about parking and potholes and paving and sidewalks and people speeding through the neighborhoods and snowplow and parks and really a lot of really good blocking and tackling things that, you know, that they want to see improved. And then there's other people that have, you know, bigger picture items that are important to them, you know, affordable housing. The fishing industry. What are we going to do with our waterfront? What are we going to do with I-4C-2? The Fuller Project. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, Tally's Corner, what are we going to do with that? There's just a lot of big issues. So Ward 2 is two places in a way. It's the neighborhoods that have their things that they're very interested in. And then many of those folks are also interested, yeah, what's going on downtown with our storefronts, with our retail, with our lighting, you know, with our sidewalks, with our cleanliness, with the environment. You know, I mean, there's so many things. The list is long.
Yeah.
It's super long, and it's really a matter of, you know, the immense amount of work it's going to take to get through that list, figure out what the list is, prioritize the list, and then get to work, which I've got a number of meetings that I've already had and are planning now. I don't really get sworn in until January 1st, but I'm not waiting.
But there's a big learning curve, isn't there, about... to get acclimated to what's happened in the past, to what the protocols are and all of that, and that doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, the protocols, you mean in terms of city council meetings, you mean?
Well, not just that, but, you know, protocols in terms of when you're allowed to speak and not speak, or when it's timely or not timely, or to weigh in on an issue. I mean, if you're at a neighborhood meeting and... you're saying, gee, this is a great idea on a plan that hasn't come before the planning board or the city council yet or the zoning board of appeals, that can sometimes be an issue. And there are other protocols about when you want to have information, you can't just wander into the police department and say, I want to know this and I want to know that. I mean, there are protocols for how candidates and then elected officials can acquire the information and tools that they need.
Right. Yeah, I think I do have a lot to learn there. I joke with people that you know, I'm a pretty excitable guy that really has, you know, goals identified and then go and they're worthy, and then go do what it takes to get those worthy goals accomplished. And I I joke with people, I'm about to run into the buzzsaw of government. So
it is that to a certain extent, but it doesn't, you know, it's just a lot to learn and a lot to cover in a very condensed period of time. Ward 2 has less people in it than Ward 5. In fact, the margin is like 1,200-1,400 people more in Ward 5. And I know it, every 10 years or so, they're supposed to look at the population and fix it so that they're more equal. Do you see that happening anytime soon, or is that something you want to kick the tires on at least when you get into office?
Well, that I read the charter, and that's in the charter, that there's five wards and they're supposed to be balanced, population-wise. So that's the charter, so people understand, is our constitution. That's our constitution. That's really the foundation of our government in the city. So, yeah, I don't know what the logistics are yet of that, and studying the charter, you know, it's terms for the mayor, terms and overlapping terms for the city council, and it's, you know, school board, and it's all the nutsy bolty stuff of government, including what you're referring to, is how do we keep the wards balanced. So it's not the thing on the tip of everyone's tongue. Believe me, I knocked on 600 doors and I don't think a single person said, "What about that charter? It's killing me. You gotta change the charter." But it's really, you know, it's got some real foundational things of how we operate as a city that we need to really look at and see if it's quite the process to change the charter. So you really have to make sure that it's significant and that we really want it, because we have to go through a real process that, you know, walking over hot coals to get that done, you know?
Well, there's three levels. There's the law, there's the charter, and then there's the city book of ordinances. And then there's societal change and technology and as an outside factor, but it changes what you do in some regard. So the trick, I think, is to look at the laws, the charter, and the ordinances as they interrelate with each other, and some of the things that are probably that, maybe not so much the charter and certainly not the law, but certainly in the book of ordinances, is we don't need to do those anymore. That was great when the wiring system was this way, but the city council doesn't need to see a report from the fire department saying something about a system that they don't use anymore. So there's a sense of someone's got to pull it all apart and say these are all the pieces and they need to fit together this way, not that way. And that's, right, as you say, not an easy task.
And just even this morning in the Gloucester Daily Times, Jim Destino talking about some of the excess cash and how he's going to allocate that to studying all these things. And, having so that, our local laws line up with the state laws, line up with federal laws, so our zoning can be most streamlined, so our charter can make the most sense. This is not glamorous stuff,
No. But
it really can make, in the end, in the long run, and even in the medium term, it can make the lives of our city and citizens so much better because it streamlines things. There's going to be less head scratchers. So, but like I say, over time these things accumulate, and they were a good idea whenever they were put in, and then times change, and you got to really look at that and make sure it's up to date in terms of our time period today.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. You still got a lot of work cut out for you in interacting with your new city councilors, and want to wish you the best of success. And once you get sworn in, maybe we can have you back early in the winter, and hopefully it's a mild winter. But although my buddy here is a skier, so he's shaking his head.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but we'll have you back at some point and talk about how it's going.
That's great. Very exciting times we're in, and I look forward to having a part in it.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
nice
Ken.
To you, Ken.
Good luck now.
Take care. Bye.
Well, another fast hour there, Mr. Arnold. And,
I think the really disappointing thing for me was I was going around the rotary and I saw a truck coming from what headed toward the hospital with a plow on it. And I said, that guy's way too optimistic or pessimistic or whatever he is. But
yeah, it's very depressing that we've had all this warm weather. I agree.
It's
very depressing. And beginning.
I can't wear shorts anymore. That's
beginning to get
upsetting.
To me. Well, Tim Kearns and Phil Stacey, men in shorts. Bob Jackson also, the Marblehead hockey coach, the Salem. Bob Jackson is the Marblehead hockey coach. Phil Stacey's the Salem News sports editor. Tim Kearns is our sports analyst, and they wear shorts year round.
Okay,
sorry. And not one of them will give in. So who's going to do it first? You know.
Yeah.
So, all right. So anyway, let's see. Next week, I think we do have a show.
We do have a show next week, and then we're off the following week.
We got to be off during Thanksgiving, yeah, and then it'll just be hit and miss during the. During the holidays. But so what are some of the things you've been working on?
A bunch of different people. I just need to pin down dates and who's going to be where. But we'll have a good show for you next week. Can't say which ones they are.
Okay, great. All right, thanks. That's Josh Arnold. Our producer and engineer, of course, is Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. Don't forget football tonight at 7 o'clock, Marblehead at Melrose on MSO News Sports. Tomorrow, a couple of games. Check out the website. For those, it'll be Tewksbury at Lynn English at 2 o'clock, and it will be Stoneham at Hamilton Wenham at 1 o'clock.